about being pro-life, and I'm just here as an observer to see what the attitude is like and kind of witness history.
And they are not going to do this to America. There's more of us than there is of them, and we are going to fight.
Demonstrators on both sides of the abortion debate outside the Supreme Court late last night and this morning after yesterday's leak of a draft opinion overturning Roe v. Wade, meaning there would be no constitutional right to an abortion in this country. This is a draft opinion circulated in February, so it could have already changed or could change when the term ends in June. But if it doesn't change, this decision will undo 50 years of precedent and protections for pregnant people. Immediately following the ruling, about half the states are expected to either ban abortion or severely restrict it. We're going to spend most of the show talking about this today and begin with Loyola Law School Professor Jessica Levinson. Welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, so let's back up a bit and lay out the timeline and the context first. So this is a case out of Mississippi, which has a ban on abortion after 15 weeks. The Supreme Court heard arguments in December. And according to Politico, who obtained this draft opinion, five of the justices have voted to overturn Roe. And also Casey, Justice Alito, wrote this opinion, and you read all 98 pages of it. What does it say?
It says exactly that. It says Roe is an egregiously bad decision. And it says that when it comes to not just, of course, that landmark 1973 decision in Roe v. Wade, but also the case that follows that, that's our current standard, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that they will no longer be the law of the land. As you said, that means that the Constitution will no longer protect the right to obtain an abortion, and this is left to the states. So about half of the states will protect a woman's right to have access to an abortion. About half the states will either immediately or eventually completely prohibit access to an abortion. And in fact, many, I think, will try to prohibit women from traveling to a neighboring state to obtain access to an abortion.
Now, you have been predicting that this would happen since basically the oral arguments, since before the oral arguments. But what was your reaction when you actually saw the draft opinion?
You know, Madeline, there's a really big difference between expecting something and talking about it in the abstract and seeing it in black and white. And so I was still stunned to see it. I still was stunned to see the court with this language, which is such aggressive and strident language, say that there is no place in the Constitution for protecting a woman's right to obtain an abortion. And of course, I was shocked that this is the way we were finding out about it. It is absolutely unprecedented that the Supreme Court has leaks of draft opinions. They occasionally have some leaks, but this is a very secretive and private branch of our government. You just absolutely cannot overstate what an earthquake this is for the court. It is such a betrayal of their norms, and it is so shattering to them. I think that's why you see the Chief Justice saying the marshals are going to investigate. So it was absolutely expected, and I was still absolutely, in some ways, honestly surprised to see it.
Well, in terms of this being an earthquake, I guess in terms of the actual effect of the decision, what is the difference between it being released now and released a month from now?
Well, of course, this is a draft. It has no legal effect. So what's the difference? I mean, it's a political difference in the sense that we have to think about who leaked this and why. Why does somebody want us to see this before it comes out? Now, somebody could be either trying to change the minds of those in the majority and say, you know, try and find a middle ground, try and work with Chief Justice John Roberts, who frankly, I think wanted a narrower decision. Or it could be that somebody leaked it to say, don't change your mind. We know how you voted before. And if you change your mind, then you just bowed to political pressure. So in terms of the effect right now, it's really largely a who's trying to exert a pressure campaign within the court? And then what does it do for us outside of the court politically that we're having this conversation in the beginning of May and getting ready for what feels absolutely inevitable, as opposed to having this conversation in the beginning of July, which is, of course, much closer to the midterms?
All right. So Justice Alito wrote this decision, and I just want to play a clip of tape of when he was a judge. And this is during his confirmation hearing back in 2006. And Dick Durbin, a Democratic senator from Illinois, asked him point blank if he believed Roe v. Wade was settled law of the land. And here is what Alito said.
Roe versus Wade is an important precedent of the Supreme Court. It was decided in 1973, so it's been on the books for a long time. It has been challenged on a number of occasions, and I discussed those yesterday, and it is my and the Supreme Court has reaffirmed the decision, sometimes on the merits, sometimes in casey, based on stare decisis. And I think that when a decision is challenged and it is reaffirmed, that strengthens its value.
All right, compare that to what is in this draft decision, where he writes, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Its reasoning was exceptionally weak, and the decision has had damaging consequences.
Well, I mean, in a way, we can say it's different, but I think the first thing it shows us is that Supreme Court confirmation hearings are really a farce. And you hear him picking these words so carefully in the confirmation hearings. It's important. It's been reaffirmed. That adds value. I mean, it's all a way of saying, I don't like the decision, but I'm acknowledging the truth that he lists the date. I mean, that's the least you can do with respect to a case, right? I understand when it was decided. I understand it's been reviewed. That's not saying I respect the case. And what we're now seeing is that stare decisis, which is just a fancy term for we're going to respect our past decisions because we don't want it to look to everybody like the law just changes depending on who's on the court, that stare decisis is very malleable. One of the factors that the court looks at is, was the case wrongly decided? I mean, according to who, right? This is almost entirely dependent on who is making that decision. So yes, every justice, as they're waiting to become a justice during the confirmation hearing, says, I acknowledge that Roe is the law of the land, but they never say the second part, right? Which is, but I've been a lower court judge. And now that I'm on the Supreme Court, or when I'm on the Supreme Court, I'll have the power to overturn that.
So, yeah, and he's not the only one. Justice Kavanaugh described Roe as precedent on precedent. Neil Gorsuch called it settled law. Did they misrepresent their views to Congress, or, as you say, kind of just made them a little vague?
Yeah, I think that they were, we can say that they obfuscated. We can say that potentially they were misleading. But I think that they did what we all acknowledge, which is that they stayed kind of vague enough to go through the confirmation hearings. They said just enough to make it sound like they said something of substance, but they really didn't convey much at all other than I acknowledge this was a decision and I acknowledge other decisions reaffirm it. It just shows that the American public really doesn't get what you want from these confirmation hearings, that people don't give the full answers, which is, you know, Justice Alito would have said, yeah, I'm going to overturn that the first moment I can. I mean, this shouldn't be a surprise to us. I think that's part of the reason that he was nominated to the bench in the first place. This is the fruition of a goal that has started by the conservative legal movement decades ago.
All right. So then what does this mean for any future rights that we think are enshrined, such as the legalization of same-sex marriage, the right to buy and use contraceptives, all revolving around this notion of privacy that Roe v. Wade is centered on? Are those in jeopardy now as well?
So Justice Alito, in his draft opinion, goes to pains to say, well, abortion is different. I will say, if you're really calling into question the right to privacy, and if you're saying, I'm not upholding Roe because nowhere in the Constitution does it say there's a right to obtain an abortion or there's a right to privacy, then yes, of course it calls into question all of those cases dealing with the rights of intimate relationships, the right to obtain contraception, the right to marry the person of your choosing, whether they be from a different race or the same sex. It creates a question with respect to all of those, that huge bucket of cases that all deal with the idea of what is protected under the right to privacy, what is protected under the liberty prong of the 14th Amendment.
Jessica, always great to get your analysis. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor, and she's our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. held not far from the Supreme Court. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are really scrambling to respond to this leaked opinion. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer promised to hold a vote on a bill that would guarantee the right to an abortion in federal law.
The party of Lincoln and Eisenhower has now completely devolved into the party of Trump. Every Republican senator who supported Senator McConnell and voted for Trump justices pretending that this day would never come will now have to explain themselves to the American people.
Still, because of the filibuster, the vote would be mostly symbolic. Meanwhile, Republicans focused on the leak of the draft decision. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell called it a stunning breach.
Somebody, likely somebody inside the court itself, leaked a confidential internal draft to the press, almost certainly in an effort to stir up an inappropriate pressure campaign to sway an outcome.
And Chief Justice John Roberts is promising an investigation. But while the leak is indeed shocking, the opinion itself has been predicted to some degree since Justice Amy Coney Barrett cemented the court's 6-3 conservative majority 2 years ago. In fact, conservative states have been preparing for it. They've passed restrictive abortion laws in anticipation the court would gut Roe. Here to talk about this is Julie Rovner. She reports on healthcare policy for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, how many states would likely ban abortions if Roe falls?
Basically half of them in very short order. You've got a number of states, I believe it's 13, that have what are called trigger laws. They've passed laws that says if the Supreme Court overturns Roe, then immediately abortion will be banned in this state. So those are laws that are waiting to be put into force. Then there are a number of states that still have laws on the books from pre-Roe, from 50 or 60 years ago, that said that still ban abortion, that were never taken off the books. And some of those would come back into effect as well. You know, the day, remember, this is a leaked draft. This is not an official opinion yet of the Supreme Court. So nothing has yet happened. But when it does become official, things will happen very quickly.
And out of all of those that you just mentioned, how many of them would ban every single case of abortion in every single instance, except perhaps for the life of the mother?
Yeah, most of them. I mean, there are a few differences. There are a few that still have rape and incest exceptions. But there would be a significant number of laws with basically no exceptions at all. There are a couple that don't have any medical exceptions.
Wow. Well, a lot of women now are turning to medical abortions because of this whole scenario. And I understand some states have already prepared for that. So how many states and what does that look like in terms of preventing women from getting these drugs and self, aborting in their own homes?
That's right. I think it's fair to say that one of the biggest things that happened to the abortion debate was when the abortion pill was approved in the year 2000. There was enormous concern from the anti-abortion movement that basically abortion could go underground, that women wouldn't have to go to clinics anymore. And so there would be no place to go and protest, and that this could all happen very quietly. The FDA for many years had some restrictions that did not allow that to happen. They had restrictions on that women actually, you couldn't get a prescription called in and go to the pharmacy and pick up these pills. You had to actually go see a doctor. So there still were women who had to go visit certain places to get them. That was stopped temporarily during the pandemic, and then it was stopped permanently by the FDA in the last year. So the idea is that there's these sort of two cross currents. One, abortion is likely to become illegal in many places, and the other, it's going to be easier to get abortion pills. Now, the question is, some states are thinking about trying to restrict the ability of their residents to get these pills by the mail, or even, crossing borders or coming back to get them. So I think this is going to be another of the big sort of tension points, is how many women are going to be able to get abortion pills, and are they mm-hmm. going to have to travel, or are states going to try to go after women who are using what's basically, according to the Food and Drug Administration, a legal drug?
Right. A legal, safe drug.
Right.
What about traveling? So I think some states are thinking about criminalizing women who travel to states that allow abortions.
That's right. We've seen just the beginnings of this. There was a bill introduced in Missouri that would basically make it a crime to travel to another state to get an abortion. And that obviously, you know, before Roe v. Wade, that was what happened. If you had the wealth, basically, and the ability, and you had an unwanted pregnancy, you could go to one of the states where abortion was legal. Most of them were on the coast, primarily California and New York. So you could travel from other parts of the country and go and get your abortion and come back. That will still be the case for many women of means, but we're already seeing the difficulties that women are having in Texas, where abortion has been effectively illegal since last September. Those women are trying to go to nearby states, but the nearby states are backed up because they can't serve basically all of the women in their states, plus all the people in Texas who are flooding out. And now those states mm-hmm. directly around Texas are the ones most likely to pretty immediately ban abortion if this decision comes down the way we now think it will.
Right. What about nationally? I've read that there are some Republican lawmakers working with anti-abortion groups who are working on a national ban that might supersede any state, you know, like California, allowing people to have abortions or travel to the state to seek abortions. Is that serious? Is that actually happening? And could that be passed?
Yes, this is one of the worst kept secrets of the anti-abortion movement, which is they say, well, you know, if we overturn Roe v. Wade, it just turns it back to the state and every state will be able to decide what its abortion policy is going to be. But the anti-abortion movement from the beginning has said, no, we want abortion to be illegal and unavailable in the entire United States so that when we get back control of the Congress and the presidency, we can pass a law that says abortion is illegal nationwide. There are some factions of the anti-abortion movement that want to take that, they want to declare personhood, that want to declare, you know, an embryo or a zygote to be a human being with full rights. That would ban many forms of birth control. So, and probably in vitro fertilization. I mean, there are people who would like to take this basically as far as they can. But, you know, the idea that for the anti-abortion movement, the win would be just overturning Roe, that's just step one.
Right. But that would have to, they would have to have a filibuster proof majority to do that. And that is not expected, even if Republicans take over both the House and the Senate in the midterms.
Well, Republicans could get rid of the filibuster. That's what they did for the Supreme Court. That's where why mm-hmm. we are where we are.
All right. Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, California lawmakers reacted swiftly and they promised to make the state a haven for women seeking abortions. They want to enshrine the right in the state's constitution. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. California Governor Gavin Newsom met with state leaders last night to address the leaked opinion that suggests the court is ready to overturn Roe v. Wade. In a statement, he wrote, "California will not stand idly by as women across America are stripped of their rights. We will fight." His plan is to amend California's constitution to protect abortion services. The specifics of the amendment are unclear, but any changes to the constitution require approval by voters. So we could see a planned change on our ballot as soon as this November. Joining us now is Assemblymember Christina Garcia. She represents Bell Gardens in Southeast LA County, and she is chair of the California Legislative Women's Caucus. Welcome to Press Play.
Hi.
Well, what do you see as what could possibly be in this constitutional amendment? What would you like to see in it?
We want to make sure that we protect the right and we protect privacy out there. And I think for us, it's about protecting our future generations. If the last 50 years and this woman have taught us anything, is that we can't leave it up to chance.
And so that would guarantee a woman's right to an abortion along the same lines as Roe, around viability or what? You know, do you have any details?
We are working on those details right now, and I don't want to talk out of place. We want to make sure we get it right, but we have a sense of urgency. We want to meet the June 30th deadline so that voters can vote on this come November.
All right. And do you see any problems getting it on the ballot?
You know, I think California has been a leader in the space. My colleagues and I, the Women's Caucus, is prepared to put its full weight behind this initiative and also the 13 bills that we have as a package to expand access and privacy as well. And so we have a pretty good track record, and I'm confident. And we've been fired up, but we've been prepared for this moment. While I'm upset that in my lifetime I'm about to lose a right and worry about what's next, I have full confidence that my colleagues are going to come together to ensure that California is a haven for women here and women across the U.S. looking for access to abortions and reproductive health.
How long have California lawmakers been preparing for this decision?
We tasked the Future of Abortion Council last year with coming up with the report and recommendations, and they did provide that in December, and we got to work as a caucus, a legislative women's caucus, and we have a package of 13 bills. The first one already got signed, SB 245, which outlaws any co-pays for abortions out there. And so we are prepared, we are aggressive, we are concerned, and I'm personally concerned for our most vulnerable community members. At a point where you're the most vulnerable out there, if you're low income, if you're of color, if you're an immigrant, if you're LGBTQ plus out there, if you live in a rural community, these marginalized communities is who we are talking about. And abortions are not going to stop, but we know that illegal abortions are going to increase. We're going to see health consequences because of that. And history tells us that we're going to see deaths. We're going to see deaths of our most vulnerable communities. If you are a community member of means, while traveling out of state isn't ideal during this vulnerable time, you're going to have access to that health care. And so for myself, for communities that look like me, I'm really worried about the moment that we're in and the attack on our rights. And I ask myself, today it's this, tomorrow what's next?
Mm-hmm. And so California has said it would be a safe haven for women out of state to come and receive an abortion. What does that mean? How many women do you expect, if Roe falls and many of these states outlaw abortion, how many women do you expect to come to California every year?
We are expecting over a 1,000% increase in demand for services here in California, where California would be the nearest place a lot of women out of state would have access to health care. And so even before this moment and the sense of urgency, we know that we need to increase access for our marginalized communities here and our vulnerable communities here in California. This moment has just expanded that urgency, and so we are aggressively working to make sure we have providers, that we have providers in places like clinics or community members go, that we have a clearinghouse of information on the internet where anyone could go make sure that they are going to a reputable provider and they will have services available to them. And then we're working to ensure that we are protecting the privacy of those providers and any patient coming out of state so that states cannot come after them for seeking abortion access here in California.
Would you put forth any measure that would mail abortion drugs to patients who couldn't travel, who couldn't afford to travel here?
I would say that there are various recommendations out there, and there has been work done around that, and we are committed to doing everything that we need to do. And so the package we have today, the constitutional amendment that we're looking at today, is one important step. But we know that this will not be all the work that needs to be done to ensure we have a system that works for anybody here in California or anyone traveling to California out there. And we are committed short-term and long-term to doing that work. And so we are working with the Future Council of Abortion, which is over 40 organizations here in the state and experts, and prioritizing access first and foremost, ensuring we have enough providers, and then moving forward with the next steps once we get that taken care of.
We just heard in the previous segment that Republicans are working on a national ban on abortions, which would supersede any California law. What is your reaction to that, and how would you try to work around that?
We are definitely very concerned about that, but I will say that this leaked preliminary opinion talks about a state right. And so California is prepared to sue, prepared to defend our rights, and prepared to defend our 40 million Californians here. And this is also why this constitutional amendment is so important. We're making it clear that, you know, the premise of how America got started and got built is that states have a right to defend their constituents. And we are committed to that, and we will fight tooth and nail, and we are prepared for the fight to ensure that our constituents are safe and anyone coming here for help, for an abortion, for anything is protected as well.
All right, California Assemblywoman Christina Garcia, who represents Bell Gardens in Southeast LA County, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, masks are off, but COVID cases are up and new variants are here.
What we're seeing now with this whole picture of these current subvariants or variants, that in fact, yes, it's every bit as infectious as we see with measles.
Dr. Michael Osterholm is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, these days, it can feel like the pandemic is a thing of the past. Just look around. Coachella, the Met Gala, the White House Correspondents Association dinner, even the grocery store. Hardly a mask in sight. But last week, COVID cases in the United States were up by more than 25% compared to the week before. So are we living in collective denial? And with new subvariants swirling, what are we supposed to do about it? Here to tell us is Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's head of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota and a former advisor to President Biden's pandemic response. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you. Good to be here with you.
Great to have you back. All right. Dr. Anthony Fauci said last week the U.S. is out of the pandemic phase. And then there was a lot of blowback, and he clarified he meant the U.S. was out of the full-blown explosive phase of the pandemic. Where do you see the United States right now?
Well, to be very frank, I don't know. And I think any scientist that tells you that they do know, be careful, because they probably have a bridge to sell you also. Right now, this virus continues to throw 210-mile curveballs at us all the time. These new variants that we're seeing surely are more infectious. They are also able to evade immune protection from previous infection and previous vaccination status. And so one of the challenges we have is we don't know which virus is going to show up tomorrow that will then have tremendous impact on where this pandemic goes. So, but if you were to take the state of the art right this moment, we'd say, yep, this is good news. We are seeing fewer cases compared to what we saw with the Omicron surge. We're seeing fewer hospitalizations and deaths. That's good news also. But I think it's very, very premature to think that we're out of the pandemic potential, meaning we could see another big surge of cases, even among those who have been previously infected and vaccinated, depending on what this virus does over the course of the months ahead.
And do we even know how many cases there are? Because so many people test at home and may not report their results to the authorities.
We don't. And that's a very important point, because the onset of cases really gives you the most immediate measure of what's happening. Because from the time you're exposed till the time you actually become clinically ill is usually about 2 to 3 days, and then coming to medical detection shortly thereafter. If you're not getting tested or you can't get tested, that surely compromises our ability to understand what's happening from a case count. But one of the other things we do look at also is hospitalizations. And that's what we call a lagging indicator, meaning that it is anywhere from 1 week to up to 3 to 4 weeks late in terms of measuring what's happening. It'd be like measuring rainfall in LA today for something that happened over the weekend. Obviously, it's not helpful. in that sense. But at this point, we're not seeing the big increases in hospitalizations either. And I think that is a very important message. It says that the vaccines and previous immunity are providing protection, not necessarily against cases, but at least against serious illness, hospitalizations, and deaths. But again, I have to emphasize over and over again, depending on what this virus does, how it changes genetically, could totally change that picture overnight.
Overnight, so that fast. Is it normal for a virus to mutate so quickly?
Well, viruses, like all living beings, change as they grow and mm-hmm. as they move forward. This particular virus was, in fact, thought early on in the pandemic not to be mutating very quickly in any significant way. Well, we learned that about a year and a half ago. Well, that's not true. Now we're learning that it's not just new variants, meaning if you think about going from alpha to beta and gamma to delta to Omicron, et cetera, all these names that we've given these different emerging viruses, all which trace back to the original outbreak in Wuhan. Now we have within this a subvariant category, BA1, BA2, BA2.12.1, BA4, BA5. All of these have different characteristics. Across the board, the more they evolve, the more infectious they become, the more transmissible they are. Right now, this virus is right up there with the most transmissible infectious viruses that we deal with in terms of breathing air in and out. Also, we are concerned because we are seeing more changes in these viruses that would mean that they are more likely to escape the immune protection we already have, meaning that mm-hmm. the immune response that our bodies have been geared up to do as a result of vaccination or previous infection just doesn't work as well in eliminating the virus. So this is the challenge we have right now, is it's not just that the virus is changing, but it's changing in meaningful ways in terms of our own protection.
Yeah. So we see that with Vice President Harris. She had 4 shots and still got infected. And she probably took a lot of precautions, but still, it is, as you say, highly contagious. Is it on par with measles in terms of its transmissibility?
Well, I've spent 47 years in the business, including a lot of measles outbreak investigations. We were the ones that documented its airflow in a large event here in Minnesota in a metrodome where the virus traveled over 400 feet from the infected person to those that got infected up in the stands. So I have a tremendous respect for measles. And I have to say, without any question, what we're seeing now with this whole picture of these current subvariants or variants, that in fact, yes, it's every bit as infectious as we see with measles. You know, there's got to be an end to how infectious it gets. But in fact, every time we see these new subvariants emerge, it's just that much more infectious than was the previous one. So it is really, truly a formidable foe in terms of transmission.
Well, with that in mind, how should we go about living our daily lives?
Well, I think there really are 2 considerations here that are very important. One is, if you're vaccinated, fully vaccinated, and I would say having your booster doses, or you've previously had infection and may have been vaccinated, may not have been, again, you really have a much better chance of not getting seriously ill, being in a hospital, and dying. That is great news. But you'd still have a chance of getting infected. And one of the things that we're very concerned about is the very real problem of long COVID. Mm-hmm. To me, that is really concerning. I have friends and colleagues who have long COVID, people who are very active, people who really were among the best of the health professionals I know, who now are basically at home, unable to even get out of bed many days or to go to work.
Wow.
That, I think, is a reason why you want to protect yourself. So I still, when you see activity like we're seeing now, I wear my N95 respirator. And I'm in public places, and I am, you know, trying at this point with what increase we're seeing in cases to avoid getting infected, because even if it's a mild illness, I don't want to develop long COVID.
So that means wearing a mask when you're indoors in public places. What about outdoors in public places? And what about eating in a restaurant?
Yeah, let me just be really clear also. I am not a pro-mask mandate individual, because mask has come to mean a term that is so far wide and reaching. You know, it's like saying a condom in which one condom has 100 holes in it and the other one doesn't, but they're both condoms. Masking has been largely misunderstood in terms of wearing a face cloth covering, wearing a surgical mask. These are largely ineffective for protecting you against this virus because of the aerosol nature. Remember, this is like smoke from a cigarette or like perfume, how it floats. So I want to be clear and say, it's not just masking, it's using high level protection, a respiratory protection like an N95. Think about that then. If I go to a restaurant and I eat and drink, what is it that we would think that a virus would take a vacation while you're eating and drinking? It would neither infect you or you wouldn't infect others. That's crazy. So I think that one of the challenges we have today is adequate protection. You can do a lot to protect yourself, particularly if you're an immune compromised individual. You want to not only be vaccinated, but you want to be wearing your N95 in public places because, in fact, there is still a risk. And we're seeing more and more of these events, these super spreading events occur all the time.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for the update. Thanks for the advice. And fingers crossed, we can get through this next one, next wave, and the one after, and the one after.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's Dr. Michael Osterholm, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Coming up, a new Netflix series celebrates the world's national parks. It's hosted by former President Barack Obama. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for TV on the radio.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yes.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There was an offer before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
Well, speaking of disasters, during COVID time, a record number of Americans headed to our national parks from Acadia to Zion. They have long been a source of recreation and peace for us. The system was created 150 years ago to protect the animals there and also to conserve the land. A new docuseries takes us inside the delicate ecosystem of our great national and international parks.
A fish that can walk. Surfing hippos want to catch the waves. Species found nowhere else on Earth.
You know that voice. It is, of course, the former president, Barack Obama. Camera crews shot over five continents and 10 countries to capture intimate footage of, for example, the elusive super tusker elephants of Africa, or a baby orca hunting off Monterey Bay, or a newly discovered species of worm in Indonesia. And they explore what these protected animals mean to us.
Scientists believe that this sloth could now benefit all of us. He's like a tiny pharmaceutical factory. Fungus in his fur produces chemicals that have the potential to fight cancer, malaria, and antibiotic-resistant superbugs.
Joining us to talk about the Netflix docuseries Our Great National Parks is the executive producer, James Honeyborn. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you. And my first question is, how did you get the former president to be a part of this?
The president, Michelle Obama, have a production company, High Ground. We were introduced to High Ground by Netflix, and it quickly became apparent that we shared common interests, and it felt a very natural fit to work together. Sorry, I should just say, not least from our point of view, because the president has such an extraordinary track record in conserving wilderness areas.
Well, what is his track record in doing so?
Well, he has preserved more wilderness than any other president in U.S. history. A vast area of the land has been protected under his tenure as president. I think that gives, from our perspective, a very real authenticity and authority for him to tell this story. The story really is, of course, our relationship with wilderness and why it's so important today.
Mm. And you decided to focus not just on American national parks, but parks all over the world. How did you choose which ones to film in?
Well, the formation of national parks was a great American idea, but it's spread across the world and it's become sort of the greatest global conservation success story of the past century. If you think about it, there's over 4,000 parks around the planet and half of them have been created in just the last 50 years. So it's actually a very contemporary world movement. And in a world with so many environmental concerns, to sort of celebrate this good news story is a great thing. And when they started forming these parks, and as you said, it's 150 years ago, they didn't know how important they would become and how vital they are to us today. And we can now see their growing value and their relevance to us all. And that was really why we decided to make the series. But when you've got 4,000 to choose from, where do you go? Where do you start? And that was our big challenge, really, was whittling it down and trying to find parks that would represent different habitats, different areas, you know, from whether it's mountains or rainforests or African savannas. We wanted to reflect a range of continents. We wanted to be sort of global across both hemispheres. And one of the things that helped us actually was looking at places that the president had a connection to. And that actually helped us whittle down to our shortlist.
Mm. So he obviously has a connection to Hawaii, which the first season opens with him on the beach of Hawaii. Where else does he have a connection to?
Well, he as a child, he grew up in Indonesia. His father was from Kenya, and he spent time there. And I believe that he and Michelle Obama went to Monterey, or possibly Monterey, on their honeymoon and saw a whale breaching out at sea.
Well, speaking of Monterey, let's talk about the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And here's a clip from your series.
Stretching along a quarter of California's coastline, from San Francisco in the north to Big Sur in the south. This unique reserve protects more than 6,000 square miles of the Pacific Ocean.
And you compare Monterey Bay to an underwater Grand Canyon. Describe what's under the water there, what it looks like.
Directly out from Moss Landing, which is in the middle of the bay, is a canyon. When it comes incredibly close into shore, of course, you can't see it at the surface, but if you scan the seabed, you find that it very quickly offshore, the seabed just falls away in almost vertical drops in places. And I know that when they record sound there, they often hear the sound of underwater rock falls, for example, and these steep-sided canyons. The abyss is very close to shore, and that's quite unusual. And that creates huge upwellings at certain times of year, which means you get very cold, very deep, nutrient-rich water flowing up to the surface as it's forced against the walls of the canyon and comes up to the top. And that creates the richness of the marine life that you get. And the reason why all the big creatures, the whales, the sea lions, the orcas, they all sort of converge into Monterey in the summer months and towards the end of summer is because that's when the upwellings are at their greatest and this whole food chain has become super abundant, massive shoals of sardines and anchovies and all life feeding on it. So it becomes really one of the greatest spectacles in all the oceans.
Mm. Right. And you have some amazing footage of all of these animals feasting on the sardines. And of course, as we know from our literature, from our John Steinbeck, that sardines were a big economic driver. And so that brings up the idea of coexistence. And this is obviously, California is very packed, overpopulated, perhaps. How are the people coexisting with this incredible marine ecosystem, and is it endangered?
Perhaps it's not quite as endangered as it was back in the 30s and 40s, when, as you mentioned, the huge canning and fishery industries were situated around Monterey Bay, and huge numbers of wildlife were being caught, killed, consumed, and really everything from sardines up to the whales. And Monterey Bay went through a period of very poor health at that time, and real ecosystem collapsed. But it's incredible how when you give nature a chance, it can bounce back. And that's what we've seen since. And actually, the National Marine Sanctuary has only been in place for 30 years. But you can see evidence of nature coming back in huge numbers and a real spectacle coming back. And that's not to say it's all perfect. And of course, one of the reasons we wanted to tell this story is because it's an example of a thriving ecosystem that is situated alongside California, which is the most populous state in America. And so that notion of coexistence is nicely there. And I think it's also amazing that you can see this spectacle from shore. You can just look out at the sea and see these great creatures, sometimes up close. So it's an amazing place to visit, and it's certainly in much better health than it was. But we've always got to remember that our wilderness areas are under threat. They're under threat from climate change. They're under threat from, you know, extinction and the biodiversity crisis. They're under threat from escalating pollution. And we can't escape those things. I'd never be confident enough to say it's been fixed entirely, mm-hmm. but it's definitely improving. And it goes to show what can be done when we take positive action, meaningful steps towards improving.
Right. You do get some really beautiful, intimate moments. You capture these beautiful, intimate moments of animals who have just given birth, for example, or who are nursing. And there's one scene in particular that was almost like an action film. It is in the first episode, and there are these leaping lemurs in Madagascar jumping across a terrain of really pointy, jagged rocks flying through the air and just catching on to these spiky rocks that just seem very difficult to hang on to, one with a little baby on her back. Can you describe how you film that and why the lemurs do this?
Yeah, so the location is the Singi de Bemaraha National Park in Madagascar. And the landscape is called a limestone karst formation. And it's this very heavily eroded limestone that creates these pinnacles of rock that can be as high as a sort of 3-4-story building. They're really vertical, they're precipitous, they're really sharp edged. And sometimes the lemurs have to cross this because they have to get their food runs out in one patch of forest, and to get to the next patch of forest, they have to cross the limestone, and it's dangerous. And of course, when the mums are making these big leaps between the towers of rock, they can't hold on to their baby. They need their arms and legs to catch the rock, to cling on. And so it's all up to the baby to be strong enough to hold on to mum as they make the crossing. Sometimes you can spy it from vantage points, or we used a drone to be able to follow their crossing. We know that they take sort of routes that they work out across this landscape, which allows you to follow them at a distance. But it just struck us that it was a landscape straight out of Star Wars, and a really engaging family that we found making that crossing.
We played a clip of tape in the intro when you're talking about the sloth and how the sloth's fur could produce chemicals that could fight cancer, malaria, or antibiotic-resistant superbugs. How does that work? What's happening there in this fur?
It's a whole sort of micro-universe, really. I think that's what's so fascinating about rainforests, is that if you look into anything in detail, there's so much more that we still don't know. And really, the sloth is an example of that. And when you look at the fur in close up, the first thing you might notice is the moths that live within the fur. But actually, the fur itself, it's kind of corrugated. And so it creates a home for this algae, which means the sloth can turn green, which is great for camouflage. It's the only effectively green-haired mammal, therefore, in the world. So it's, you know, really unique like that. But within this damp, humid environment, you also get fungi and bacteria, and often it's these microbes that are offering new advances in medicine. But we had experience in other rainforests as well, where we would look into the detail of the place and discover something new, like in Gunung Losa National Park in Indonesia, which is the fifth episode in the series. We were looking for a hammerhead worm, which is this really cool little predator that hunts slugs and snails. And it turns out that no one could identify the species we found, and it's believed to be new to science. So just by looking on the forest floor, we discovered something potentially, you know, a new species. So that's really exciting. And again, it just tells us how much we still don't know about these rainforests and therefore how precious they are.
How did you know you had discovered a new species?
Well, because we speak to the scientists, the experts, and we show them the pictures, and that coloration was on that particular worm was unknown. We also actually filmed a rock iguana in the limestone karst formation with the lemurs, the shifakas, and that too has been very recently identified as a new species by looking at the DNA of it, and they compare it to the DNA of other rock iguanas and discover that it's unique.
Sounds super exciting. Well, it's great to see all the images. They're beautiful and just awe-inspiring. It's nice to connect to nature even through the TV. So thank you so much. And thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks very much.
That's James Honeyborn, executive producer of Our Great National Parks, streaming now on Netflix. And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We are at KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.